Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 16th of July. The gathering storm, what happens when global warming turns millions of destitute Muslims into environmental refugees? That's the question that is asked by George Black as he travels Bangladesh, and the story is published in On Earth, which is published by the National Resources Defense Council. Bangladesh, he writes, and its 150 million people, the world's largest population compressed into an area the size of Iowa, have somehow contrived to have too much water, too little water, and more water of the wrong kind. The long-range apocalypse facing the country is global warming and the accelerating sea level rise that will accompany it. We'll be talking with George, who is articles editor for On Earth magazine, about his travels to that part of the world and all the fascinating and alarming things that are happening in terms of environment, in terms of flooding, and in terms of the rise of some fundamentalist religious thought in that part of the world that may also have a bearing on it being a catastrophic or prone to catastrophe in terms of the environment and in terms of people getting along with other people. We welcome phone calls for George during this hour. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hello, George.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks so much for being with us. Could you give me, because I was having a hard time figuring out exactly where you were. Where all did you go in Bangladesh? You were all over the place, and there were different facets of the country that had different levels of importance.
We were there for 2 weeks, and we essentially split the time between the better part of a week in Dhaka, the capital, and another week in the southern coastal area. A lot of that by boat, traveling through the mangrove forests on the border with India, the Sundarbans, and then I spent also a couple of days in Kolkata on the Indian side of the border. So we saw a fair variety of the country, I think.
And tell me about what you describe as too much water, too little water, and more water of the wrong kind.
Yeah, well, I say in the piece, it's really the country's existential curse. Mm. The water problems they have, it really is, you know, old cliche, it's the perfect storm. They hit from every side. They're very flat. Most of the country is 10 feet or less above sea level, which means that you have these huge rivers that come down from the Himalayas, which are very prone to flooding because they're very sluggish. They carry a lot of sediment. And so they flood all the time. That's a constant risk. So a lot of the country is protected, or semi-protected, by polders, sort of Dutch style. In fact, the Dutch have helped them a lot with that. Then from the Himalayas, two things are happening. One is that the glaciers are melting very rapidly because of climate change, and that's having two effects. One is that in the short term, you have too much water and too much risk, increased risk of flooding from the rivers. And secondly, once the glaciers have melted, they'll have too little water. And some of the major rivers, the Brahmaputra, for example, completely dries up in the summertime. And you're talking about a river that's, you know, a mile or more wide being completely dry.
Oh, my.
Then the other aspect, monsoons are very heavy, cyclones from the Bay of Bengal, which are increasing in strength very much for the same reasons as Hurricane Katrina and the intensity of hurricanes here from the Caribbean. Ocean temperatures are rising. And then finally, the sea level itself is rising. And the latest projections are that by the end of the century, we could be talking about sea level rises of 4 feet or more. And what that will do, and is already beginning to do, is it floods the coastal areas with salt, so you can't farm them.
Mm-hmm. So there already have been millions of environmental refugees.
Well, it's hard to measure numbers. Environmental refugees is a very elusive category because, of course, there's always been in developing countries a lot of migration from rural areas to the cities and out of the country. But there's no doubt a lot of people we talk to are saying that the pace of people leaving the villages is now on the increase. They had a devastating cyclone last November, which was still very, very visible several months after when we visited. And they're losing their fields to salt. A lot of the fields that they used to farm rice on are being turned into shrimp farms for export to countries like the U.S. So a lot of your local shrimp, in fact, comes from these fields that used to be growing rice and can't any longer.
You say that no country in the world, or somebody you talked to said that no country in the world will face greater devastation from global warming, and we'll get, do these in two parts, and nowhere will the potential political fallout be harder to manage. Why is it that this country in the world will face greater devastation from global warming than any other?
Because I think this is very generally agreed. This is not a controversial view now. It's extremely low-lying, and it has a lot of population crammed into very low-lying areas. And they're going to lose, by the most conservative estimates, about 15% of their entire surface territory.
Oh,
I mean, the country's going to go underwater. There are Pacific islands that are subject to that, but they're tiny, and they have tiny populations. Now, the political dimension, which sets Bangladesh somewhat apart, is that it is, first of all, it's a basket case of a country politically. It's under emergency rule. There was a bloodless military takeover. The political system is a shambles. So it's potentially quite unstable. And secondly, there are the beginnings, very early days, and you don't want to be alarmist about it, but I mean, there are the stirrings certainly of a much more conservative form of Islam taking root in a country that's traditionally been extremely moderate and pluralistic religiously. So that's a concern, certainly.
You mentioned the fact that it's hard not to recall a videotaped message from Osama bin Laden in 2007, adding global warming to the list of plagues that Western countries have inflicted on the Islamic world.
Well, that's right. And what's alarming about that is really two things. One is that, of course, once that kind of message gets stirred up by people like him, it doesn't take many people, as we've seen in other situations, to cause a lot of havoc by exploiting that kind of message. The second thing that's interesting is that although that's the rhetoric that bin Laden is adopting, it's also, frankly, a very, very widely held mainstream view in a lot of the world that the causes of global warming and the impact of global warming are two completely different parts of the globe. You know, the developed countries, by and large, are responsible for creating the problem. And the poor countries that don't have the resources to stand up to it, many of which are already desert or semi-desert countries, are going to have worse droughts. Many of which are low-lying coastal countries. They're going to bear the brunt of the problem. And, you know, this rhetoric is not something that's restricted to, you know, people have been Laden's ilk. This is pretty mainstream conversation now at the UN, for example.
And they're trying to figure out what to do about it?
Yes, and they are pretty overwhelmed. As I say, politically, the Bangladesh government is a mess and doesn't have many material resources to deal with it. Internationally, it's a very, it's probably an unprecedented dilemma for the international community to deal with, in the sense that it's going to be a very, very complex set of emergencies. And you're going to have humanitarian emergency. You're going to have major public health emergencies following from disease patterns that are changing. You're going to have major refugee flows. And then you add on to that this potential security problem. So you have to do a lot of planning for that. And we're already, it has to be said, not very good at planning for humanitarian emergencies of the type we already have to deal with.
And we have
it's worrisome.
And we have to plan for what, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
Well, it's an incremental process. And the impact at first is slow motion. You don't really have an immediate overnight sense of things changing. But certainly over 20 years, depending on what we do in the meantime to slow down emissions, carbon emissions, the results are going to be quite dramatic by then. And your concern, obviously, then is in the short term, what political consequences may start to arise. How are people going to start using this situation to grind political axes? And that's very unpredictable. You know, politics, in a sense, are as unpredictable as the exact course of climate change and the exact impact it's going to have.
And why don't you tell me about what you saw? The article talks about signs of a shift. The training center, the Imam training center in Bangladesh, operating under the auspices of the lavishly funded Islamic Foundation, now including the environment in the list of topics its trainers use to inspire the imams of mosques in order to create consciousness in the society. Tell me more about that growing movement and the conversations that you had with people from that movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can read that two ways, and there's an encouraging way to read it, it has to be said, and there's a more, I don't want to say alarming, but certainly a reason that gives you some cause for concern. The positive thing is that, of course, it's a thoroughly good thing if local communities become more aware of not only global warming but environmental problems. And the imams in Bangladesh have not historically played a very active role in local politics. They tend to do, you know, birth, marriage, and death, basically. But if they're concerned with issues of water quality and public health, I mean, that's all to the good, of course. What is more troubling is, again, if more conservative views of Islam start taking hold, and you know the other interpretations, which could be very populist, you know, rousing popular anger about the reasons for their predicament, then that gets much trickier. And there's no doubt that a lot of both the Islamic Foundation, which I write about a little, and the general trend you see in these coastal areas towards more conservative, visible forms of Islam. Now, a lot of that is being funded by money coming in from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. So again, there may be more than one agenda at work there.
You also talk about the changes in cultural activities here, that the mm-hmm. lines between Muslim and Hindu were very blurred. They're not so much as they used to be.
Well, it's an interesting country because it is the third biggest Muslim population in the world, but it does have a minority population of probably about 11% of Hindus. And we visited, you know, several mixed villages, and generally people live next door to each other. They have tolerant, harmonious relationships for the most part. It is historically a very open-minded form of religion on both sides. But the conservatism is definitely creeping in, and people I talked to who were expert on what's going on at the village level certainly talked about, you know, more religious schools coming in, more madrasas. We saw certainly many, many more women wearing the full veil, the burqa, in those areas. So community festivals, things that used to be forums for dialogue among the communities, theater groups who would come and visit and spark discussion of contemporary issues, those, I was told, are being replaced more and more by essentially Muslim prayer meetings.
Mm-hmm. Tell me the story about the tigers.
Well, that's yet another twist to this story.
Really?
The area that I said we spent a few days on a boat touring around this very remote and incredibly for Bangladesh, totally unpopulated area, which is a huge mangrove forest called the Sundarbans. And it's an amazing system. It's the biggest mangrove in the world by far, by a factor of 10. And it's home to a lot of endangered and threatened species, including the Bengal tiger. It's really, on both this and the Indian side of the border, it's one of the last holdouts. There's a few hundred Bengal tigers. And a lot of people in the villages are being attacked and killed and eaten by tigers for a lot of different reasons. And a lot of people are pointing the finger at climate change because the tigers' supply of fresh drinking water in this forest is disappearing. The water is becoming salty. Apparently, when tigers drink salt water, they suffer all sorts of physical ailments, which make them aggressive, and they come more into villages looking for food and water. They're extraordinary animals. We didn't see any. They're extremely elusive. But they're dwindling in numbers. And once this mangrove forest goes, which it almost certainly will completely disappear, so will the tiger.
Mm. So you met this. It's a small world, isn't it? This English-born tiger expert mm-hmm. from the University of Minnesota.
Yep.
Yeah.
He was doing God's work, as it were, in that part of the world, trying to not only learn more about the tiger and learn more ways of protecting it, you know, putting radio collars, for example, so you can track individual tigers, but also educating people in the villages that although the tiger is a threat to them, it's also in their interest to protect this incredible animal that is, you know, the national symbol of Bengal, which straddles the Indian-Bangladeshi border. So when a tiger comes into the village, traditionally, hundreds of people come out with sticks and surround it and beat it to death, and he's trying to persuade them to do otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting guy.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. George Black is our guest, articles editor for On Earth magazine. His latest article, The Gathering Storm, is in the summer issue. If you'd like to go to the website, it's a fascinating story, www.onearth.org, onearth.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Did I give you the number? 486-8655, or send an email if you would like. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. George writes, no country in the world will face greater devastation from global warming. The signs, of course, are already there. And nowhere will the potential political fallout, this is where the story becomes even more intriguing, be harder to manage. Millions of people will be permanently displaced, made into environmental refugees, and the great majority of them will be destitute Muslims. And it's hard not to recall a videotaped message from Osama bin Laden in 2007 that added global warming to the list of plagues that Western countries have inflicted on the Islamic world. All this put together, and without being alarmist, you can't help but wonder if all of these dots might not over time begin to join us. All right, two more phone calls in a moment. Or to phone calls for the first time in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for George Black. Our number is 800-486-8655, and lines are open for you. If you are joining us in Milwaukee, the number is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Mike from Appleton, hi.
Yeah, good morning. I have two comments. They don't necessarily relate directly to Bangladesh, but first of all, there's an area of the world that I'm very intimately familiar with, and that's the Amazon jungle. And talking about this global warming thing, if you go to Google and go to Maps and type in Iquitos, that's I-Q-U-I-T-O-S in Peru, and take a look at the Amazon River and how it comes by that city, you'll be able to notice that the river is receding from the city, and it has been doing that now for the last 10 or 15 years. And if you fly over that region, which I've done hundreds of times at all different levels and in all different times of the year, and you look at the way the river courses and then the tributaries of the river course, it's a natural evolution. I don't know if global warming per se has anything to do with that, but it would be interesting for your guests to look at that area. That was one point. The other point that I'd like to make, and which is kind of wrapped up, you know, this whole global warming issue and resources and everything, I believe that we are at what will be called in the future, let's say the Iraq War, the beginning of what we're going to be calling the resource wars. And I'd like your guests' comment on those two points.
Thank you. Those are interesting questions. The first one, I have to confess, is a part of the world I really don't know much about. I was there probably, 30 years ago, but I haven't been back since. I don't know the explanation of the Amazon receding there, except that there is so much variability of the impacts of global warming that obviously some places are going to get wetter, some places are going to get drier. And it's very, very hard. I'm not familiar with the Amazon basin to know which is responsible. On the resource wars, I mean, I think the argument really that actually all wars historically are essentially resource wars. People tend to go to war because they want what their neighbor has in terms of resources, or because they don't have enough and they have to find new territory. I think you can look at pretty much all wars through that paradigm. But certainly the political conflicts that are already beginning, you don't want to say that any one of them is ascribable solely to global warming. But there's an element of global warming and environmental degradation, certainly in Rwanda, where people were competing over increasingly scarce farmland. In Darfur, there is definitely a climate-related element there. In the lack of resources in the Middle East, we're certainly going to see a diminution of resources in of water resources, above all, in an area that's already very conflicted. So I wouldn't say this is the beginning of the era of resource wars, and I would say more that it's the beginning of another episode in the ongoing series of resource wars.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about what has happened in the intensity of certain cyclones, the fury of cyclones that you write about that gather their strength from the Bay of Bengal, and what's happened as a result of those storms to farming and to fishing and to places for people to live.
Well, they're part of this general phenomenon where, you know, I always make the comparison to cancer clusters. If you've got a cancer cluster, you can't prove that every single case of cancer in that neighborhood is because of the environmental toxin, but you see a broad pattern. You can't ascribe any single cyclone or hurricane to global warming, but the pattern is clearly increasing everywhere of extreme weather events. The floods in the Midwest, as you will know, this summer were, people are now talking about 100-year floods becoming 20-year floods. In terms of the impact economically on a coastal country, yes, it devastates a whole series of a sequence of environmental activities. If you're a fishing-based economy, if the overall environment is being degraded, you tend to lose forage fish, prey fish at the bottom of the food chain. If you have species that migrate in and out of salt water and the salt water creeps further inland, then those are diminished. The fishermen in Bangladesh and the coastal areas we spoke to, they're catching a fraction of what they used to catch 10, 20 years ago.
So how are they living?
I'm sorry?
How are they living? How are they able to make a living?
Well, with great difficulty. I mean, they are fortunate historically in that it's very, because it's alluvial floodplain, you know, the soil, to the degree that it's still free of salt, is extremely rich. And traditionally, it's been a very productive country for rice particularly. That's changing. People don't have the access to as much basic crop income as they did. Food prices have been devastating everywhere for a whole variety of reasons in the last couple of years. Oil prices being one, crop failures because of weather being another, market imbalances. So they're affected by that tremendously in Bangladesh. They're spending, I don't know the percentage exactly, but certainly more than half of their income is now going on basic food.
And when you talked earlier about shrimping replacing farming in this area because of what's happening to the land, tell me about these companies. You talk about them as big shrimp companies getting hold of farmland. Is it a matter of people being able to switch employment and start to work for these companies? Where are these companies from?
Hello?
Hello?
I keep losing you. I'm sorry, your line's breaking up. I think I got the gist of the question, though. The companies who run the shrimp business are essentially Bangladeshi companies. There's 100 and some local companies. The government, about, I think, 15 years ago, decided to promote export income through, they've got very few natural resources for export. Mm-hmm. So they decided to promote shrimp and fish culture for export. What happens is that you get a vicious circle there, which is that people who lease small farms are very vulnerable if somebody comes in and wants their land. They either get bought out or they get bought out with the help of a little muscle being applied. So they lose their land, which is then flooded with salt, deliberately flooded, I mean, with salt water from the rivers. And once the land becomes saline, it becomes impossible to farm, and it also seeps into neighboring farmland. So if you're next door to a shrimp farm, your rice harvest is likely to be affected.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, the shrimp is all destined for export. This is not stuff that's eaten locally. It goes primarily to Japan and the U.S.
Let's talk about the capital city for a moment. You write that in any given country, the capital city is the customary magnet for desperate migrants who are running from rural poverty. But in the case of the capital, Dhaka, it's a bit of a mess.
Put it mildly. You have to have a sense of gallows humor to live in Dhaka, I think. You know, the phenomenon of migration to the cities is obviously global. And you look at Mexico City, Lima, scores of big cities that have doubled in population because of migration. I've never seen a place that was so unequipped and dysfunctional in the face of that kind of migration. It's a city of 12 to 14 million people. It's going to double in the next 12 years.
Oh, my gosh.
It doesn't begin to work. Millions of those people are living essentially hand-to-mouth, destitute, living in the streets, living on the edge of open sewers in, you know, tar paper shacks. So it's very hard to imagine how the city is going to go on even functioning to the degree it does now.
And you talked earlier about disease. You mentioned in the article that due to these variety of forces, you're starting to see things like malaria appear in Bangladesh at times of year that it normally wouldn't appear. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, again, it's a worldwide phenomenon. There are a lot of epidemic diseases that are on the increase. Malaria is spreading both geographically into new areas. It's spreading into more northerly latitudes. It's spreading upwards in altitude. You're getting it in areas of Kenya, for example, now in the mountains where it didn't used to exist because the mosquitoes have tolerance of higher altitudes with the temperature. But you're seeing a lot of things, dengue fever, Rift Valley fever in Africa, things that we've seen in this country, West Nile, mosquito-borne diseases in general. Allergies are increasing here as a result of global warming because ragweed does very well in warmer temperatures and more carbon in the atmosphere.
What was it that made you want to go to this part of the world to do this story, George?
Well, it's part of the world I didn't know before. I'd traveled in China and Hong Kong and written on both of those, had not been to South Asia previously. And I've really become fascinated by some of the issues that I think are going to mark the next phase of thinking on the environment. Your caller a moment ago talked about the military or the security aspects of it. There are a lot of things, you know, the environmental movement took years to get global warming on the map.
Mm-hmm.
I think people now generally accept the degree of the problem. And we have to start thinking 20, 30, 50 years into the future, what are the next generation of issues going to be? And really, as I said earlier, Bangladesh is the place everyone agrees is going to suffer the biggest humanitarian impact. And I'm interested in humanitarian, public health, refugee, migration issues that are going to derive from global warming and the degree of planning we're going to have to do to cope with them. So that was really the set of reasons that took me there.
And do you think that we're too late by a number of years in trying to adequately address these issues?
Well, I mean, I'd say yes, but then when you say yes, people throw up their hands and say it's all
right.
Hopeless. And, of course, it's never hopeless. It could almost be worse. We've lost a lot of time. There's no doubt. I mean, Jim Hansen, who is the main climate scientist at NASA, testified before Congress 20 years ago, and he said this is a serious problem. The science is essentially all pointing in the same direction. He testified before Congress 3 weeks ago for the 20th anniversary, and he said, really, we have done next to nothing, and we've lost the slack in our schedule, I think was the way he put it. So we're starting way behind the curve of where we need to be. On the other hand, you start from where you are, and you don't waste a lot of tears on wishing you were somewhere else. I mean, you start from where you are, and where we are is that it is extremely urgent. We have to take action immediately. The U.S. has to take the lead in taking action because until this country does, there will be every excuse in the world for other countries not to.
Mm-hmm. You spoke with a former British ambassador to the U.N., meeting him at Oxford University. He said one answer is to create a world environmental organization and for that organization to have real enforcement powers like the World Trade Organization. Does that strike you as a grand idea?
Well, it's a big idea that needs a lot of fleshing out. His notion is essentially that just as trade and the global economy means that no country is an island. It's all inseparable. The trade practices of one country affect another. In the interest of fairness, you have an organization that arbitrates disputes, sets rules. So his notion for the World Environment Organization is something similar to that, and he told me he talked to the head of the WTO, who thought it was an excellent idea. And of course, you know, carbon dioxide, carbon emissions in the atmosphere are global. Environmental problems in general are global. I mean, a lot of the smog and air pollution in California now is coming from China. Mm-hmm. This stuff does not respect national boundaries. Getting that to be an enforceable legal regime is obviously going to be extremely hard. The WTO has been hard, and this one will be harder. But it's, you know, you have to be encouraged that people like this ambassador, Sir Kristen Tickell, are beginning to think in those terms.
We're going to welcome more phone calls. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. We're talking with George Black, articles editor for On Earth magazine, who spent a couple weeks in Bangladesh, and his article in the summer issue is The Gathering Storm. You can find it at www.onearth.org. He looks at what has already happened in terms of environmental problems because of global warming, sea levels going up, etc., stronger cyclones. Areas that used to be farmland are now used for shrimping, and the money is not really staying in Bangladesh. It's the shrimp are going to Japan and to the United States. And he also looks, you know, what I think is one of the more fascinating parts of this, at the political ramifications of all of this. When asked about the major cyclones and global warming, and he gets the response, well, the question is, what do you think is responsible for all of these changes in the climate? And the answer is, we see the will of Allah, call to follow Islam. It's not just an act of God, then, he asks, because some people think the rich countries are also to blame. Do you believe that? And the answer frequently is yes. It's an article well worth reading. It's something I don't think we think about very much and probably should. So join us, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. If you would like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. George Black, our guest, articles editor for On Earth magazine. And we go to John from Pewaukee. Hi, John.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, George. I have a comment. You just spoke about the solutions for all these problems and that, the fact, for better lack of a better term, we're behind the eight ball now. I'm 43. When I was a kid, Carter was and he told us that there we are. And so George has said, you know, we basically have done nothing. One of the things I notice is, just with my anecdotal kind of thing, my 12-year-old son, great school, but there is no ecological curriculum. I think, you know, my question is, isn't the time that ecology...
Your phone is really fading on us. What about environmental
Kathleen,
education?
I wonder, could you just convey the gist of that?
I could, George.
I'm sorry.
He has a 12-year-old son who's getting very little environmental education. Is it not incumbent on all schools all over the world to take this into the curriculum?
I mean, that's a great point. And I think even more, I have a couple of teenage kids myself, so I'm certainly aware of the deficiencies in that area. I think, you know, it reflects something more generally about the kind of experience that kids have now, which is that the relationship, I mean, I'm of an older generation. I have kids, as I say, who are 17 and 19. When I was younger than them, when I was a kid, you know, you'd come home from school, you'd run out in the woods, you'd play games with your friends, you'd kick a ball around, you go around the streets of an American city now after school, there's no one there. Mm-hmm. Kids don't have that first-hand experience of the outdoor world, which I think is where, you know, one's consciousness of the environment tends to begin, through the actual physical experience of being in it. The curriculum, I think it's a real problem. The the textbooks are not keeping up, the science departments are not keeping up. A lot of that, I think, you know, state educational authorities tend historically to be quite conservative. There has been, whether or not it was well-founded, there has been controversy around this issue for many, many years, in particularly in certain states of the country where educational authorities are quite slow to move. I hope we're over that now and that the skepticism, the so-called global warming skeptics, have finally disappeared from our life because they took up far too much of our energy. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll see schools and educators responding to that.
Yeah. Thanks so much, John, for the call. Let's go to Spencer from Cedarburg. Hi, Spencer.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, George. Hey, you mentioned earlier in the program that the Dutch were in Bangladesh lending some expertise. Can you comment on what projects you're working on and how successful they were or have been?
The Dutch?
Mm-hmm.
They've been involved there, I think, for about 40 years. You know, they have not only tremendous experience in protecting land that is below sea level, which they are, but they also are spending a lot of money and doing very ambitious things to protect themselves now against the sea level rise that's going to occur. I think the Netherlands per capita is probably spending more than any other country. How successful have they been in Bangladesh? I'd say mixed. The scale of what they have to do in Bangladesh is so overwhelming. The defenses that they put up there, because you have different conditions in Bangladesh than in the Netherlands, you don't have monsoons in the Netherlands. Part of the problem is that if you build dikes and create polders for agriculture, and then you get a monsoon, then the fields are flooded. You know, if they're not flooded from one side, they're flooded from the other side. It's kind of a double whammy. I think some of the Netherlands projects, I was told, were not as well designed as they might be. Follow-up and maintenance is very, very hard in a country with a sea resources as this. So a lot of the dikes that were built have failed or have degraded over time. But I think certainly the Netherlands has done more than any other country.
Oh, interesting. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. As we talk about these issues, and you mentioned in the article, it's easy, right, to sink into despair here, but Bangladeshis, despite being battered by centuries of natural and man-made disasters, seem the least despairing, the most resilient of people. Isn't that something?
Well, it is. I mean, it's inspiring, frankly.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a great example to learn from. I mean, the people with least in the world tend to be, in my experience, both the most resilient and, frankly, the kindest. I've never experienced the kind of kindness. I mean, I've traveled a lot in probably about 50 countries reporting and traveling, and the degree of hospitality, of optimism, of, you know, people have very, very tough lives, and they will complain that, you know, they don't have as much food as they used to or they can't make a living. But they are extraordinarily well, the only word is the one I use, resilient. And mm-hmm. I think we should have a bit of humility about that because we have so much and we tend to lapse into despair quite easily.
Mm-hmm. We sure do. Let's go next. Thanks, Spencer, for your call. We go to Ellen from Brookfield next. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Well, I want to go back a little bit to the comments about the fundamentalist religion taking over so much and in Bangladesh. And the sort of surprise that, oh, the people are, you know, accepting the comments that Allah is displeased and, you know, this is because, you know, because of not following, you know, Allah's word and blah, blah, blah. And that there could even be a modicum of surprise at that when one considers that whichever one of those religious right leaders said after Katrina that this was God's retribution on our wickedness in this country, and how many hundreds of thousands of people in this enlightened country repeated that afterwards. I mean, I've heard people who I thought were normal say things like that. And, you know, I think when society worldwide, when we get stressed and fearful and worried about our resources, and you know, in this country we have way too many that we take advantage of, people turn towards finding a way to go at each other, to they get very fundamental, whether it's, you know, believing in some weird sun thing or, you know, or some extremely rigid type of Christian or Muslim or Hindi or whatever religion, we tend to go that way. And I find it not even remotely surprising that in other countries that's happening when it is so much happening here in a country that it's not supposed to happen in.
Mm. George.
Hello, Kathleen?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm having this problem with your line again. I am losing so much of these questions. I think the question was generally the fundamentalist or very conservative religious response in all religious traditions to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, certainly that's true. I mean, I think I'd make a distinction, which is important. I think, yes, there are strong fundamentalist or extremely conservative currents in every major religion. I would draw a distinction, however, between people in Asia or Africa who, frankly, are not in possession of the kind of factual information that we have.
Mm.
And historically, yes, when forces beyond your control impact your lives, it has always been true in every society that there is a tendency to believe that it is, you know, divine will, that everything is ordained by a divine power, and we're pretty powerless to do anything about that. But I would make a distinction between that and some of the responses we get in the developing, in the developed countries, in the United States and others, where we do have the information. The scientific knowledge is there. So here, in many sectors, it's more a question of willful disregard for what should be knowable. And I'm more troubled by that, frankly. I tend to think that in other countries, as more information is disseminated, the kind of understanding, I hope, would grow rather than, you know, retreat more into name-calling and blaming and, you know, dragging in other agendas that it's so-and-so's fault or it's a punishment for such and such a moral deviation.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, when it happens in this country, it does trouble me more.
Mm-hmm. And we've had some conversations about that recently, that we just don't seem to trust science very much in this country for whatever reason, and it's to our detriment, and it could be to the world's detriment, and maybe already is.
Yeah, we don't. And I would, I'd say there are a couple of reasons. I would have to say, and I have great respect for scientists and for science, that scientists have historically not been very good communicators.
Right.
I think a lot of them are now beginning to recognize that fact, that somehow if you put scientific analysis and theory into lay language, you're somehow betraying the purity of your science and your academic credentials. And I think a lot of scientists are realizing that they need to do a much better job. They need to learn to be communicators, talk to journalists, talk in terms that are comprehensible to the rest of us. So I don't entirely blame, you know, the lay audience for that level of lack of knowledge.
And thank you very much. Let's try this phone call, and I hope you can hear all right. Chad from Portage. Hi, Chad.
Hey, how you doing?
All right. How are you, Chad?
I'm doing pretty good. All this stuff about global warming, right?
Right.
Wisconsin, all this up north, the United States was under ice back 10,000 years ago. Did we build too many campfires and melt them or something?
I'm sorry, I didn't get you either on that. Did we what?
No, I didn't.
Did we build too many campfires and melt them or something?
Did we build campfires and melt the ice?
Yeah, in northern United States, was under ice back 10,000 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Did we build too many campfires back then and melt them?
I'm not sure where you're getting at that. Maybe George does. George, do you get where we're going?
I'm sorry, you're going to have to repeat the question for me.
Did we were under a lot of ice 10,000 years ago, did we build a lot of campfires and get rid of it?
The ice disappeared because of its own reasons. I don't think our campfires had anything to do with it. I mean, the Earth has warming and cooling cycles, and there's been a tendency among some quarters recently to say that we're just in another warming cycle. This is not another warming cycle. Those variations are much, much, much smaller than the variations we've seen in the last 200 years. But on the glaciers disappearing now, I don't think our campfires were the cause of that.
Right. Let's talk about this. You mentioned this, and I was interested in hearing more about it. This Organization of Islamic Conference, a group of 57 Muslim states, starting to do more work in the area of climate change. What are they doing, George?
I don't think they're doing very much at this point. I think it's more a question that the awareness of the issue is beginning to take root. And I don't see this, and I wouldn't want it to be interpreted as an ominous sign, because I think the worst trap here is to fall into the prejudiced view that if the Islamic world is doing something about it, it must be bad. I think the Islamic world, like any other part of the world, becoming more knowledgeable about climate change and other environmental issues and their causes is a thoroughly healthy thing. So to the degree that not only Islamic states, but Islamic theology is becoming more involved in this, I think that's all to the good. I mean, Islamic mm-hmm. theology, which I am absolutely not expert in, but from the little I understand and from the scholars I spoke to, there are essentially instructions in the Quran which are quite similar to what is in the Bible. Christians talk about the creation mandate to be good stewards of the earth. There's language in the Quran that is extremely parallel to that. We have to look after the earth, be good stewards. That to me is encouraging. And if people within Islam are beginning to become more attuned to that, that's great.
Right. So of all your time there, and the article is filled with some hope and it's filled with some great discouragement. What sticks with you? What's most discouraging here, and where are the signs of hope?
Where I find them everywhere, in the people. Frankly, I will never, I'm not sure if, you know, my work will take me back to Bangladesh, but I found the people there absolutely unforgettable. Part of what's so attractive is that this is really an unknown country, and it's not a touristed country. You don't see other Westerners. I think in 2 weeks we probably saw, at most a dozen.
Oh, my.
There's no real history of those negative interactions that often make you feel very uncomfortable as a visitor in other parts of the world where I've traveled a lot, in Latin America, for example. So there's a very direct and natural quality to your exchange with people, and I just find that wonderfully refreshing.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of being worried, what are you worried about?
I am worried. I think all of us are worried, and all of us who work in this field, I think the biggest challenge we face is to have real worry that is grounded in fact and in knowledge, but not to convey or promote an attitude of hopelessness. Because the worst thing we can do, and I have to say, there is the occasional tendency among environmentalists to sound gloomy and doomy, and people switch off. People don't become engage with issues they feel they can't control.
Mm-hmm.
And this is still within our control. And so although I'm extremely concerned and, yes, worried, and I don't want my kids to grow up with the consequences of this problem not being dealt with, you cannot let this paralyze you.
Right. Where do you live?
I live in New York City, in Manhattan.
Oh, you do? I was expecting you in the British countryside or something somewhere.
No. Long time ago, once upon a time. Kept the accent, but not much else.
Yeah, that's all right. So where do you go next, sir?
The next story I have scheduled is to go to Costa Rica and look at a country that was the first real pioneer of the idea of ecotourism and is now promising to be the first country in the world to be completely carbon neutral, to have no net carbon greenhouse gas emissions, which will be an incredible challenge. I know Costa Rica. I was actually there earlier this year, and they're trying something extremely ambitious and very encouraging.
Mm-hmm. You really get around, don't you?
I do. I have to say I've seen a lot of the world.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, George, for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure for us. George Black. George is articles editor for On Earth magazine, and it's the cover story of this month's issue, the summer issue of the magazine. As the sea rises, millions of people in Bangladesh will become environmental refugees. Most of them will be impoverished Muslims. So he looks at the political consequences of that, and he also looks at what's happening right now in a country where the sea level is rising about 3 millimeters a year, a little more than 1/10 of an inch. It's going to get worse. And what's happening to farmers and people who fish and people who are living on the land and their land is flooded and where they're going, and they're looking at religious fundamentalism growing in that part of the world because they're blaming the Western countries for some of the problems in terms of global warming. So he spent 2 weeks traveling Bangladesh and says that no country in the world will face greater devastation from global warming, and nowhere will the potential political fallout be harder to manage. Millions of people permanently displaced, made into environmental refugees. A great majority of them will be destitute Muslims. And it's hard not to recall that message from Osama bin Laden in 2007 that added global warming to the list of plagues that Western countries have inflicted on the Islamic world. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program. Thanks to John Anderson for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, of course, always to you for all of your phone calls. Lots of interesting hours of conversation ahead, so we hope you'll enjoy them and hope you enjoyed today. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute now before 11, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.